59-year-old Sandra Prince was well known in the Bay Area of Florida. Kind, compassionate, and altruistic, she dedicated 30 years of her life to helping those who needed it most. Then, one quiet December night, she mysteriously vanished. Much of the search for Sandra was mired in the details of her life. Notoriously private, few knew exactly what she'd been up to, nor who she was spending her time with. Eventually, it was discovered that she'd had a secret relationship with a married man, her contractor, Earl Pippin. As detectives began digging into Pippin, he stopped cooperating and hired a lawyer. In September of 2006, 9 long months after the disappearance, investigators officially named Earl Pippin as a person of interest. Among the reasons cited were inaccurate information he'd given to police, questions regarding his travels in the days leading up to and following Sandra's disappearance, and the claim that Pippin was listed as the sole beneficiary to Sandra's estate, valued at nearly $3 million. Following that announcement, investigators would conduct multiple digs at a property connected to Pippin. They'd reveal the discovery of new evidence, put forth a theory regarding jealousy, and then, in a shocking twist, would turn their attention to another member of the Pippin family. Was this a case of a jealous lover striking out in a moment of rage, the aftermath of an argument revolving around rent money, or one person being pulled into someone else's plot? This is Trace Evidence, Episode 192, The Disappearance of Sandra Prince, Part 2. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today, we conclude our look into the mysterious disappearance of Sandra Prince. Before getting back into the case, just a few quick notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on unsolved murders and disappearances. You can follow the show on social media on Twitter at TraceEvPod, Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, or by searching Facebook for Trace Evidence. If you're interested in supporting the show and getting some Trace Evidence merch, there's a Patreon at patreon.com/traceevidence, or you can donate directly via PayPal. Visit trace-evidence.com for all social media links, donation options, and contact information. You can submit case suggestions through the website or email me directly at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. This year, CrimeCon will be taking place in Las Vegas, Nevada, and I'll be there representing Trace Evidence on Podcast Row. If you're planning to attend, you can use promo code TRACE to save 10% off your ticket. For more information, visit CrimeCon.com and remember to use promo code TRACE to save 10%. I look forward to seeing you there. When Sandra Prince vanished in late 2005, no one could have imagined who would want to harm her. As the investigation began unraveling details of her closely kept private life, Sandra's secret boyfriend quickly fell under suspicion. This is The Disappearance of Sandra Prince, Part 2. Sandra Alice Hamby Prince had dedicated much of her life to helping others. Moving from her native North Carolina down to the Bay Area of Florida, she'd spent the greater part of 30 years working to help those in the community. As a co-founder of ACTS, the Agency for Community Treatment Services, Sandra was directly involved in the formation of programs and services aimed at aiding those suffering from substance abuse issues. From the late 1970s until her mysterious disappearance, Sandra moved up the ladder, becoming a top-level administrator. According to friends and family, Sandra was devoted to her work and her clients above almost everything else. By December of 2005, Sandra was twice divorced with no children and living alone in a home she'd purchased 5 years earlier in Temple Terrace, Florida, just a few miles from her office at ACTS. Notoriously a very private person, some of Sandra's closest friends and family members were unaware how she spent her free time. Over the years, she had purchased several different plots of land, homes, and Section 8 housing. Oftentimes, she went in with a partner, whether it was a coworker, someone she'd met through work, or someone she'd connected with through another friend. This resulted in the 59-year-old owning more than a dozen properties and heading an estate valued at just under $3 million. On Tuesday, January 3rd, Sandra's gardener, David Jarrett, neighbor and close friend Nancy Sackville, and contractor Earl Pippin were all present at the Temple Terrace home. None of them had heard from nor seen Sandra since the week before, and for anyone who knew her, it was very out of character for her to be out of touch without giving notice prior. Finding her home in a neat and orderly condition, Jared and Sackville grew concerned when they discovered Sandra's purse missing, but her cell phone, which she always carried, left behind on a kitchen counter. In the garage sat Sandra's personal vehicle, a 1994 white Buick Park Avenue. How she could have traveled anywhere without her only car was another concerning question. Investigators tried to learn more about Sandra's private life, believing her disappearance might be tied to someone that the missing 59-year-old held close to the chest. Several people would reveal that Sandra told them she'd been seeing a married man, someone with whom she co-owned property. According to police, that man was none other than Earl Pippin. At first, Pippin denied having any relationship with Sandra outside of business and also claimed that he didn't own any property with her. County records contradicted the latter statement, showing he did co-own a home with Sandra around Lake Panasoffkee. As the investigation progressed throughout the summer of 2006, the Sumter County Sheriff's Office conducted several searches of Sandra's Lake Panasoffkee property, even utilizing cadaver dogs, but nothing was found. Investigators with the Temple Terrace Police Department would go on to release both video and still frame images of an unidentified individual disguised behind a ski mask driving Sandra's car in the days following her disappearance. This unknown person made several withdrawals from her bank accounts using her debit card, which has never been found. Police requested the assistance of the public in identifying the man, however, they were never given a lead that panned out. Then, in September of 2006, more than 9 months since Sandra had last been seen, everything changed. Calling a press conference, the Temple Terrace police officially named a person of interest, Earl Cranston Pippin III. At the time, investigators noted that Pippin had both maintained and lied about an intimate relationship with Sandra, despite having been married at the time. His wife, Gail, filed for divorce 1 month earlier, and Pippin had moved to a home around Lake Panasoffkee. In addition to allegedly lying to investigators, detectives claimed that Pippin had stopped cooperating with them, hired a lawyer, and refused to answer questions, and reportedly, Pippin was listed as the sole beneficiary for Sandra's $2.8 million estate. We now move back into the case with the disappearance of Sandra Prince, Part 2. After Pippin was named a person of interest, he somewhat disappeared from the world. He wouldn't speak to reporters and directed all journalists and law enforcement officers to his lawyer, though at the time, he wouldn't even disclose the name of his lawyer. In an interview with the Tampa Bay Times, Sandra's ex-husband, Luke Horvath, was asked about Pippin. Horvath had only met him once, at the birthday celebration that was held for Sandra months after she vanished. He explained to the Times, quote, "If he is the person, he managed to dupe us. He presented himself as a grieving boyfriend," end quote. While Horvath hadn't detected anything suspicious about Pippin when he met him, there was one aspect of the investigation that confounded him. Asked about Sandra naming Pippin as her sole beneficiary, Horvath replied, quote, "I don't think it's something she would have done. I don't think she knew this guy long enough. Sandra was very, very careful with money and partnerships. When we were married, she didn't tell me what was going on in her account, and I didn't tell her what was going on in mine," end quote. Many of those close to Sandra found it hard to believe she'd name Pippin as her beneficiary, but at the same time, she was so private about her life that no one could be certain one way or the other. For detectives, it became a priority to dig into Pippin, but more specifically, his relationship with Sandra. They hoped to determine how long the two had been seeing one another, how business factored into their lives, and of course, where Pippin was and what he was doing during the period in which Sandra disappeared, and in the days leading up to the missing persons report being filed. For the rest of the year, police would spend the vast majority of their time following up on leads and trying to find any potential connection between Pippin or anyone else and Sandra's final days. In January of 2007, more than a year after Sandra's disappearance, the Times ran a featured series of articles digging into Sandra's life, including interviews with friends and business associates. Through their investigative journalism, the Times made an interesting discovery. While Sandra kept her private life exceedingly private from those close to her, she often confided in people she employed. 7 years earlier, when Sandra had purchased her Temple Terrace home, she seemed to be at the beginning of a long cycle of change. From her clothes to the interior decoration of her home, Sandra wanted to transform her world into something more becoming of her ideals. Around that time, she became interested in feng shui, a practice which revolves around arranging furniture and pieces of a home in order to instill a balance with the natural world. Kat Hansen was hired on as her feng shui consultant, and it would be through Hansen that she'd meet Pippin, who worked as a general contractor and was open to making purchases and changes based upon feng shui. Kay Reed, an employee of a local women's clothing store, noted that Sandra was moving away from her usual casual look of jeans and t-shirts, opting now for fancier dresses and makeup, but it was slow progress. Reed explained, quote, "She would always say to me, 'Now have patience with me. You will get me to wear makeup. I'm just slow.'" End quote. Reed was aware of Sandra's relationship with a married man, though she knew little else of it. Close friend Susan Horton knew of her relationship, but was unaware that the man she knew only as Earl was married. David Jarrett, Sandra's gardener, who continued working at her home following her disappearance at the request of her mother, Dovey, was unaware of the relationship, believing he likely wasn't told because of his strict Christian values. Sandra would have known he would not have approved. The Times also spoke with Detective Michael Pridemore, one of the lead investigators on the case. Asked about Pippin being named a person of interest, Pridemore explained, quote, "He is one of the people in her very private life that actually knew a lot about her. With him not wishing to talk to us and no longer communicating with us, it just piques our interest as to why. I don't know if he knows anymore. If he continued with us and continued to dialogue with us, I'd be able to answer questions that I need to have answered. I can't get them answered." End quote. Pridemore noted that at the time, they couldn't rule out the possibility that more than one person was involved in the disappearance, but Pippin remained the only person of interest. Asked about the previous search conducted by the Sumter County Sheriff's Office, Pridemore explained that 6 months before her disappearance, Sandra had purchased her 9th property around Lake Panasoffkee. That home, located on Country Road 300, was under the process of having the land cleared around it. During the period in which Sandra disappeared, believed to be between December 28th and January 3rd, a large quantity of fill dirt had been laid at the home, so they wanted to ensure Sandra hadn't been buried there. At the time, nothing had turned up following their search. Asked about the status of the case, Pridemore noted that in the 12 and a half months since Sandra disappeared, they had conducted 300 interviews and followed up on more than 150 leads. Pridemore himself admitted that he'd been up to Sandra's properties at Lake Panasoffkee approximately 50 times in the previous year and figured he'd be going back again. Pridemore also commented that ever since her daughter's disappearance, Dovey Hamby had been visiting Temple Terrace on a monthly basis, staying in her daughter's home and speaking to investigators about the case. Pridemore described her as a dedicated mother who was willing to go to the ends of the earth to find her daughter. Sadly, however, just 2 months later, Dovey would pass away. On Friday, March 9th, police in Boone, North Carolina, conducted a wellness check and found Dovey lying in her garage. Apparently, she had fallen hours earlier and had laid on the cold concrete floor, which had drastically lowered her body temperature. Dovey was rushed to the hospital, but 2 days later, on Sunday, March 11th, she passed away at the age of 92. Teresa Mosteller, Dovey's lawyer, was by her side during her final hours and later told the Times, quote, "She knew she would never see her again in this life. She said she was going off to be with Sandra." End quote. During her last year, Dovey had grown close to Pridemore, as well as Detective Darren Berberat, telling others that she had great faith in them and trusted them to bring her daughter home. Pridemore had hoped to find the answers before Dovey passed, but in March he flew to North Carolina to attend her funeral, saying that her death had only strengthened his resolve. 5 months later in August, attorney William Kalish, representing Earl Pippin, filed a petition with the court to unseal Sandra's last will and testament. Police had previously reported that Pippin was listed as the sole beneficiary, so he and his lawyer sought to see this for themselves, with Pippin denying any knowledge that he was in her will. Attorney Kalish argued that his client, if indeed the sole beneficiary, should have access to execute the will and to preserve her assets. Judge Susan Sexton, however, denied this motion, stating that, according to Florida law, a missing person was not legally eligible to be declared deceased until 5 years had passed, and with Pippin not being an immediate family member, he would have no access to see her will. Asked about this turn of events, Susan Horton told the Times, quote, "To think that her life has boiled down to people arguing over her money is revolting and so far away from any principles Sandra stood for. It's just so maddening because in my mind, I've dreamed up that the police know a lot and have a lot, but they don't have enough to make things stick." End quote. While the case seemed to be stuck in place for the time, investigators were unable to move forward on Pippin without more information, and all other leads they pursued were hitting dead ends. They had no way of knowing that Dovey had adjusted her own will in hopes of helping them in the hunt for her daughter, even from beyond the grave. In September of 2007, when Dovey's will was executed, it was learned that she had elected to bequeath property valued at more than $500,000 to the Temple Terrace Police Department. As an agency, the Temple Terrace Police had an annual budget of $7.1 million, making Dovey's contribution remarkable, to say the least. Police Chief Tony Vallong explained to the Times, quote, "It was totally unexpected, and the first time I've seen anything like this in my 38 years with law enforcement. I'm proud of the officer's work ethic and the relationship they developed with her mother. That's pretty typical of all people in our department." End quote. Dovey's lawyer, Teresa, concluded that without her daughter to leave her estate to, Dovey had elected to leave it to the closest she could get to Sandra, the investigators trying to find her. While this was a bright spot for detectives, it did create one potential area of concern. With Pippin allegedly being listed as sole beneficiary to Sandra's estate, some of the property left by Dovey would be subject to Sandra's will, as mother and daughter co-owned it. Of the $500,000, approximately $108,000 might be up for grabs. However, at that point in time, there remained 3.5 years before she could legally be declared dead, so neither Pippin nor anyone else could do anything about it until a court would agree. While lawyers tried to sort out the mess, the case would take another sharp turn. On Wednesday, October 17th, investigators zeroed in on a house in South Tampa. The house, which had begun construction in 2005, was built by Pippin in his role as contractor. While several pieces of information piqued the interest of detectives, one detail was more captivating than the rest. On Thursday, January 5th, 2006, 2 days after Sandra had been reported missing, Pippin had gotten approval to pour a concrete slab on the property. Investigators were very interested in determining whether or not Sandra might have been placed beneath that slab. 2 backhoes were utilized to begin tearing up the property, with the Temple Terrace police spokesman Mike Dunn noting that ground-penetrating radar had been used and indicated an anomaly beneath the concrete. Pippin would go on to hire former prosecutor and defense lawyer Paul Sisko, and Sisko was less than pleased with the approach of investigators, telling the Times, quote, "They can dig all they want. They're going to find no link between Mr. Pippin and her disappearance. I've seen no evidence that Pippin is a beneficiary of this will. He has no financial interest in this whatsoever. He has an interest in her being found or being returned to the Tampa area." End quote. Sisko argued that while police had said his client stopped cooperating and refused to take a polygraph test, he had taken one, administered by an examiner with 30 years' experience working for the FBI. Mike Dunn, however, noted that they didn't know what questions had been asked, and no members of their police department had been present nor allowed to ask questions during the polygraph, and so to them, it meant nothing. The search at the South Tampa house continued into Thursday the 18th, where investigators held a press conference in the driveway. At the time, they noted the home had previously been searched, though with a far smaller team. They noted that Pippin had been involved in the home's construction, which was ongoing during Sandra's disappearance, and that back in December of 2005, Pippin lived in a home with his former wife less than 2 miles away. The purchase of the home, located on West Vasconia Street, had been overseen by Don Watkins, who was upset about the police digging. Watkins felt Pippin was a foolish person to focus on, noting that he'd made a lot of money working with Sandra, and it simply wouldn't make sense for him to be involved in her disappearance, which would have impacted his earning capacity. Watkins told the Times, quote, "When I found out she and Earl had an affair, I was flabbergasted. I didn't know he had it in him. He doesn't impress me as being smart enough to take a woman and kill her. Would you kill the goose that laid the golden egg?" End quote. On Monday, October 22nd, police ended their dig after 5 long days. According to investigators, their focus was on gathering soil from beneath the home and the slab in order to determine whether or not human remains might be there. Approximately 295 pounds of dirt was gathered inside of 59 tubes, 5 feet in length, being collected by archaeologists from the University of South Florida. These samples were then turned over to the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, who would analyze the soil in search of any evidence of human remains. At the time, spokesman Mike Dunn noted that they hadn't found any evidence visible to the naked eye, but pending analysis, they might have reason to return to that property. Attorney Paul Sisko referred to the search as a waste of time, saying there was nothing to find. He then went after the police for not releasing the details from the analysis, saying, quote, "They certainly like to throw media parties when they want to disparage a person's name, but not when it's time to reveal results of investigations inconsistent with their guess," end quote. Mike Dunn, however, retorted that the analysis could take months, so it wouldn't really be possible for them to reveal the results, you know, until they actually had them. In order to dig at the West Vasconia Street home, police had needed to acquire warrants through the court showing the reasons why they were focused on that property. In the late days of October, following the dig, the court documents were unsealed, and there were several new and fascinating details revealed in those warrant applications. Much of the applications revolved around a painting. Sandra had spent $6,000 hiring an artist to paint a portrait of her and her garden. Ultimately, the painting, which was still hanging in the home at the time, would go on to show Sandra as well as her gardener, David Jarrett. The artist, when speaking to police, told them that Sandra had remarked that the man in the painting was married and had children, so sadly nothing would ever come of it. After consulting with an FBI profiler, the Temple Terrace police were advised that it was possible this portrait may have created a jealousy for Pippin, who may have been angry enough to kill. One warrant describes this as Pippin experiencing a narcissistic injury. Initially, due to his connection to Sandra and being in the portrait, investigators wondered if perhaps Jarrett might have been involved. However, he fully cooperated with them and even took and passed a polygraph test. Jarrett told investigators that while he worked for Sandra, the two got along well, but there'd never been anything romantic between them. Sandra knew his wife and had taken the couple out for dinner in the past. According to Jarrett, he struggled to address Sandra as anything other than Miss Prince, even when Sandra urged him to call her just by her first name. Jarrett went on to tell investigators that he had previously mentioned to Sandra that they should have some kind of a system by which to pass information back and forth. Many times he would work in her garden while she wasn't home, so he wanted to be able to notify her of what he'd changed and for her to be able to give her thoughts and make suggestions in response. Sandra went out and bought several journals, which were kept in the garage on an iron-framed table with a marble top. According to Jarrett, while it began as a simple exchange of short notes, their writings grew over time, expanding beyond work and including discussions regarding politics, religion, and life in general. Eventually, the two would fill 2 or 3 journals worth of notes. Speaking to the Temple Terrace police, they confirmed for the first time that these journals were among items missing from Sandra's home when they searched it the day she was reported missing. In addition to this, they stated that a picture of Sandra and Pippin, which had always been sitting on her bedside table, was also missing, as was a towel from her bathroom. According to court documents, Sandra's maid told investigators that she last saw the picture of the couple in Sandra's bedroom on the afternoon of Wednesday, December 28th, 2 days before Sandra was reportedly seen at work on the 30th. According to the warrant applications, when Jarrett was asked about the journals, investigators wanted to know if an outsider reading them might think the two could have been just more than friends. Jarrett noted that, for he and Sandra, they were just a way of communicating, but he could see someone who didn't know them thinking that their writing was a little flirtatious. This, combined with the painting of Sandra and Jarrett, began making police wonder if perhaps Pippin may have been jealous of their relationship and lashed out angrily in response. Reportedly, the FBI profiler also told detectives that this was not a random crime, but one perpetrated by someone who had an intimate relationship with Sandra. In terms of Pippin himself, the applications contained several details regarding conflicting accounts he'd given detectives, as well as questions regarding his activities on the day she was reported missing. The documents note that, when asked about the painting, Pippin initially told police that he thought the man in it was the artist. When asked about it later, he stated that he knew the man was Jarrett because Jarrett had told him so. During a different interview, Pippin allegedly told police that Sandra had asked him to be in the painting, and when he declined, she asked if it would be all right with Jarrett being in there, and he claims that he told her he was fine with that. On January 3, 2006, Pippin was present at the Temple Terrace home alongside Nancy Sackville and David Jarrett when Jarrett called to report Sandra missing. However, Pippin left the home before investigators arrived. Court records state that Pippin told Jarrett he needed to take his son to a doctor's appointment. However, he told police that he had gone to Sandra's office to speak with one of her co-workers. In a later interview, Pippin stated that he'd gone to the office to speak to a man named Richard. Following this, he told investigators that he had gone to a job site, either at San Pedro Street or perhaps Pearl Avenue, both of which were located in South Tampa. However, according to police, city records showed that construction had been completed at both of those locations by that time. Interesting to police was the fact that Pippin failed to mention his job site on West Visconia Street, also located in South Tampa, where the concrete slab was poured just 3 days later. Phone records obtained by detectives showed that after leaving Temple Terrace that day, Pippin did indeed travel to South Tampa, with his phone pinging off cell towers near I-275 and Rome Avenue, then the Leroy Selman Crosstown Expressway and Himes Avenue. If indeed the two aforementioned construction projects were completed, it was theorized that he had to have been heading to West Visconia Street. Additionally, phone records showed that Pippin placed two calls to the Acts offices that day, one lasting 47 seconds and another for just over 2 minutes, leading many to question why he'd called twice if he'd allegedly gone there in person. Also in the warrants was a conversation investigators had with Pippin following their discovery of the ATM surveillance footage. According to detectives, when Pippin viewed the footage, he remarked that the man looked like him. An interrogator then asked Pippin if he normally dressed like that, noting the ski mask and other garments, and according to the warrant, Pippin replied, quote, "What am I wearing?" End quote. Police also noted that on November 17, 2006, nearly a year after Sandra's disappearance, they found a glass vase with a yellow ribbon tied around it at the West Visconia Street home. Inside of the vase was a plant which grew in Sandra's garden, and while the vase did not belong to her, one of Pippin's fingerprints was recovered from it. Beyond this, the warrants confirmed that, back at Sandra's home, traces of her blood were found in the trunk of her car, as well as in her bedroom, on the garage floor beneath the car, and on the overhead door. There was evidence that someone had attempted to clean the garage, as well as the door, and that someone had also cleaned the bedroom floor. Police also determined that someone had driven Sandra's car for at least 2 days prior to her being reported missing. Unfortunately, they weren't able to determine exactly when Sandra's blood had been spilled, and up to that point, they were relying on co-workers reporting that she'd last been seen alive on December 30th. However, that was about to change. On Friday, October 26th, the Temple Terrace police officially pulled back, saying they could not be certain that Sandra was actually seen on the 30th. While some coworkers did report seeing her that Friday, they weren't absolutely sure, as it had been a busy week and Sandra often worked out in the field. Investigators stated that evidence they had discovered may indicate that Sandra disappeared as early as 2 days earlier, on Wednesday the 28th. Detective Pridemore explained, quote, "There's doubt when she was actually at work between Wednesday and Friday. It was a holiday schedule, so they're not sure if she was there on a certain date. We're not certain of the last time she was seen. We do know it was some time between the 28th and 30th. End quote. According to detectives, the 28th stood out for several reasons. That was the last day her maid saw the picture of her and Pippin on the bedside table. It was the last day Sandra logged in on her home computer, and it was also the last time the missing 59-year-old had used her credit card. Investigators also stated they were in possession of Pippin's cell phone records going back to the 28th, but at the time, they weren't willing to divulge anything they may have learned from those records. Pippin's lawyer, Paul Sisko, argued against the information in the warrant applications, telling the Tampa Tribune, quote, "There are inconsistencies in the affidavit between what law enforcement swears under oath to be the truth and what Temple Terrace police have continued to include in their press releases in the case. The affidavit omits material facts, like the witness of the person at the ATM. Most significantly, their dates and timeline are inconsistent. Also, the coworker that saw her alive on December 30th, it's a break in the timeline they can't tie Mr. Pippin to in any way. They have a problem with the timeline if the search warrant implies foul play happened between the 28th and 30th, and they know she was seen at work on the 30th. End quote. Sisko also stated that his client had given police his fingerprints, a DNA sample, and had offered to allow them to search his property. 1 month later, in November, Sisko released a letter to the police in which he demanded that the results from the soil analysis finally be revealed to the public. Sisko claimed to have a source who told him that the analysis had been completed and no evidence in connection with Sandra's disappearance had been found. Asked about this, spokesman Mike Dunn was incredulous, telling the Tribune, quote, "It's preposterous. Police have not seen anything. We don't know where he's getting this information from. There are no results." End quote. Dunn added that they expected to have the results back sometime in the next 2 weeks. On Friday, December 29th, it was revealed that the police had spent $21,000 digging at the West Vasconia Street home, and as of that time, they had not noted the discovery of any evidence. Sisko went to the media, claiming that police already knew they weren't going to find Sandra there before they even began the excavation. Sisko argued that the theory revolving around Pippin becoming jealous from the painting was foolish, and that the only real information police had in their warrant applications involved what Pippin allegedly said about the surveillance video, comments which Sisko referred to as completely fabricated. Sisko noted that the warrants ignored an eyewitness who had seen the man at the ATM with his mask off, which may have cleared his client. Friends noted that Pippin was not as large as the man seen by the witness and did not have long dark hair, but instead short-cut light hair. Sisko also accused police of failing to use even the most basic software to analyze and clean up the surveillance footage. Detective Pridemore responded that they hadn't put a great deal of faith in the eyewitness's description, as he'd only seen the suspect in the dark and hadn't come forward for weeks, making his recollection fuzzy. Mike Dunn explained to the Times, quote, "They were looking for evidence there might be a body under the house. Just because you know what someone does or doesn't look like doesn't prove there would be something under that house." End quote. Dunn went on to say he had no idea what software Sisko was talking about in regard to the surveillance video, but they'd be more than happy to follow up on that should Sisko wish to advise them. Dunn noted that Pippin had stopped talking to police after their fourth interview with him, and that if he wanted to discuss it further, they were open to that. Sisko retorted with, quote, "I can tell you this, he's never going to talk to them." End quote. As 2007 came to an end, it marked the 2-year anniversary of Sandra's disappearance, believed to have occurred between the 28th and 30th of December 2005. While little progress had seemingly been made during their dig at the West Vasconia Street home, less than 2 weeks later, police would return to that house with much bigger plans. We'll get into that after a quick word from this week's sponsors. These days, it feels like every show I watch is a copy of something else. You can almost quote the next line before they say it. That doesn't happen when I watch Eggcorn TV, though. The best place to get shows from Britain, Ireland, Australia, and beyond. Everything I watch feels new and original, and there's something new to discover every week. Eggcorn TV is the largest commercial-free British streaming service that features compelling stories, exclusive premieres, and originals you won't find anywhere else. Eggcorn TV has hundreds of exclusive shows from around the world, including award-winning mysteries, dramas, comedies, history, and so much more. The series you can find on Eggcorn TV are cleverly written, visually striking, and feature renowned actors and hosts like David Tennant and Mary Berry. Lately, I've been checking out Conviction, The Case of Stephen Lawrence, and if you're listening to Trace Evidence, I think it's right up your alley. Conviction is an Eggcorn TV original miniseries that premiered on February 21st, based on a true story. On the 22nd of April, 1993, 18-year-old Stephen Lawrence was murdered in an unprovoked racist attack. 13 years later, Detective Chief Inspector Clive Driscoll, played by Steve Coogan, reopens the case on a mission to bring peace to Stephen's parents and justice to the perpetrators. Directed by BAFTA winner Alric Riley of The Walking Dead, Bridgerton, and NCIS, The Independent gave this series 5 stars, calling it a noble piece of television, and I have to agree. For someone who loves true crime, this one stands out as a must-see, and now, thanks to Eggcorn TV, you can watch it anytime. You get thousands of hours of new enthralling content on Eggcorn TV for a fraction of the cost compared to most streaming services at just $5.99 a month. I love how I can watch on my Fire TV from the comfort of my own couch, or on the go on my cell phone, or even on my laptop when I'm supposed to be working. I never have to miss catching up on my favorite shows. For original shows from Britain and beyond, Eggcorn TV has them all. You're going to love it like I do. Try Eggcorn TV free for 30 days by going to eggcorn.tv and using my promo code TRACE, but you have to enter the code in all lowercase letters. That's ACORN.TV, promo code TRACE to get your first 30 days for free. Eggcorn.tv, code TRACE. I wish these bags under my eyes would just go away. If that sounds like you every morning, you're not alone. Bags and puffiness under the eyes are a problem for millions of Americans, until now. Introducing GenuCell Plant Stem Cell Therapy to visibly reduce puffiness under the eyes. Anyone who's met me in person or watched a live stream knows this is something I struggle with. I've had bags under my eyes for years, and no matter what I've done, I've never been able to get them under control. I've been using GenuCell for a month now, and I've got to admit, I'm really surprised by the results. Twice a day after washing my face, I apply GenuCell to the bags under my eyes, and each time I watch as the skin firms up and the bags just melt away. I love how it lasts for a full 24 hours, so whether I'm just having lunch with friends or heading in for a long business meeting, I don't have to worry about looking tired and droopy. Having such an amazing experience, I've already been recommending GenuCell to all my friends and family. So you may be asking, why GenuCell? Like most people, you've probably tried numerous anti-aging skincare products, claiming to erase wrinkles, lighten dark circles under your eyes, brighten skin, and restore a more youthful appearance. No doubt you've been disappointed, but GenuCell products really work. GenuCell's anti-aging skincare products are based on antioxidants, natural substances proven to help repair and prevent damage caused by sun, wind, pollution, stress, and other external and internal factors. Their unique antioxidant skincare products are endorsed by doctors and celebrities. GenuCell promises results that'll make you smile, guaranteed, or you get 100% of your money back. Right now, GenuCell's most popular package is 60% off at GenuCell.com/trace. Treat yourself and a loved one to the absolute best skincare in the world. Just go to GenuCell.com/trace and enter my special promo code TRACE for a free gift plus an additional 20% off when you purchase their most popular package. Free priority shipping for a limited time, too. That's GENUCEL.com/trace. GENUCEL.com/trace. On Thursday, January 11th, 2008, Temple Terrace police arrive back at the West Vasconia Street home with a warrant in hand and a construction crew at the ready. At 9 a.m., police confirmed they'd been granted a warrant allowing them to search the home and property, while one construction worker told the Times he'd been brought up to help rip up the floor. The crew brought jackhammers, crowbars, and concrete saws, among other items. Asked about their return to the home, Detective Pridemore explained, quote, "The results are back, and we're back here to dig to find her," end quote. The heavy work began at approximately 11:15 a.m., with construction workers seen piling wood and other materials in the garage. According to police, ground-penetrating radar previously used at the site had shown anomalies beneath the home in areas they couldn't access. These areas were noted as being beneath a staircase, as well as the kitchen island and cabinets. When the construction crew left 4.5 hours later around 3:45, the staircase had been completely disassembled. Investigators stayed on the scene for another hour, noting they'd be returning the following day, and they left patrol officers behind to guard the scene. On the third day of digging, the Temple Terrace police were joined by the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, as well as Tampa detectives, as the house was in Tampa's jurisdiction. Warrants for this new search revealed that the soil analysis conducted months earlier had confirmed the existence of human remains. A large green tarp draped over the rear of the home obstructed reporters' views of what was going on inside, though it was noted that the Florida Department of Law Enforcement had exited the home with a large black bag, which they transferred into their van before leaving the site. The home was again guarded by patrol officers as further searching of the house was set to take place after the weekend. On Friday, January 18th, 1 week after the dig began, investigators were once again using ground-penetrating radar, though this time they were focused on the home's driveway. Detectives contacted GeoView Incorporated to do this round of testing. At the time, investigators would not comment on what had caused them to search in the area of the driveway, saying only that the radar search would help determine how much longer they needed to spend at the house. Mike Dunn explained to the Times, quote, "The search warrant says they can continue as long as they need to, as long as it's an active search. Whatever it takes to restore the house will be done at the city's expense," end quote. After nearly 2 weeks spent at the home, gutting much of the inside and digging beneath and around the property, the search officially ended on Wednesday, January 23rd. At the time, investigators confirmed that no human remains had been found. However, they noted that the search had allowed them to develop new leads, which they would now be pursuing. No investigators would comment on what created those leads, nor what may have been found during the search. A judge sealed the warrants used for this second search at the request of the police, who had been advised to make that request by the Hillsborough County State's Attorney's Office. The warrant was listed as sealed, quote, "until the release of discovery to the defense or until further order of the court," end quote. All told, detectives had spent approximately 500 hours at the house, though no human remains were found. Asked about this later, Paul Sisko told the Times, quote, "Obviously, I'm not surprised. I said my piece. I really have no further comment about it," end quote. Unfortunately, Sandra's case would grow quiet around this time, with investigators revealing nothing new as months began passing. In August of 2008, it was revealed that, since the start of their investigation, the Temple Terrace police had spent approximately $195,000 in their search for Sandra. 1 month earlier, in July, friends and co-workers had gathered for a special event. A new building, designed to offer long-term housing to 14 homeless people, was completed and ready for operation. The building, located on North 17th Street, was dedicated to Sandra and officially named the Sandra Prince Samaritan House. Planning on the project had taken approximately 2 years, and co-workers, knowing this is the kind of thing Sandra would have fought hard for, wanted to dedicate the building to her so that, even years after her disappearance, Sandra was still making a difference in the community. There wouldn't be any new developments or announcements regarding Sandra's case for the next 5 years. Then, In January of 2013, the Temple Terrace police reported that they would be making an announcement regarding the case. On Thursday, January 10th, investigators officially upgraded Sandra's case from that of a missing person to homicide. This decision was made after the city had convened a cold case review panel, which included the Temple Terrace Police, Tampa Police, Florida Department of Law Enforcement, anthropologists from the University of South Florida, and the FBI. The group reviewed evidence and utilized new forensic technologies to examine previously discovered items. Temple Terrace Police Sergeant Michael Lowell noted that, while he couldn't go into details, there were things that had come out of that study to move them forward. Ken Albano, then chief of the Temple Terrace Police, told the Times, quote, "Several investigation avenues have been presented to us. We intend to investigate every one of them," end quote. Sandra's friends and family were also present for the press conference, in which it was further announced that a $100,000 reward was now being offered for information leading to an arrest or to the recovery of Sandra's remains. It was noted that this reward money came out of the properties that Dovey had willed to investigators 6 years earlier when she passed in March of 07. According to police, more than 5 years had now passed since Sandra's disappearance, and while Pippin could try to claim the estate, he hadn't yet petitioned the court. Patrick Carney, a close friend of Sandra's, spoke at the conference, saying, quote, "The best hopes for a good outcome faded long ago, and now any finality or accountability would be welcomed by her friends and family. Sandra deserves that peace, and this community deserves the opportunity to account for its own," end quote. 2 weeks later, new court documents revealed the direction in which the investigation was heading. According to an affidavit for a search warrant filed in Hillsborough County Circuit Court, Sandra's gardener, David Jarrett, told police that 6 months prior to her disappearance, Sandra had had a falling out with Earl Pippin's son, Patrick. According to Jarrett, Patrick wanted to stay at one of Sandra's Lake Panasoffkee properties without paying rent, but Sandra didn't agree, and this created a rift. The search warrant, for which police were applying, was tied directly to an unopened letter. According to the affidavit, investigators had found a sealed letter written by Sandra and addressed to Patrick when they searched her home the day she was reported missing. Previously, they didn't believe the contents of the letter would have any material impact on their case, but following Jarrett's statements about the falling out, they now wanted to read it. Investigators stated that the letter, which had been mailed, was returned to Sandra's home because the post office couldn't deliver to the address she had written. The letter was postmarked on December 17, 2005, 10 to 13 days prior to Sandra's disappearance. Police noted that, while his father was a person of interest, Patrick wasn't, but they did want to speak to him about the case. Unfortunately, Patrick refused to speak to investigators, and they couldn't compel him to do so, with the police issuing a statement reading, in part, quote, "We are not naming him a suspect or a person of interest at this time, but we are interested in the relationship between Patrick and Sandra. Anyone with knowledge of the relationship between Sandra and Patrick is encouraged to contact the Temple Terrace Police Department," end quote. While so much attention had previously focused on Pippin, many were shocked to find his son being sought for questioning. Sadly, though, this is where the case remains today. There haven't been any major developments nor breaking news regarding Sandra's case in nearly a decade. As of this time, Earl Cranston Pippin III remains the only named person of interest, and as far as has been publicly disclosed, the Temple Terrace police have never interviewed his son, Patrick. Sandra Alice Hamby Prince is believed to have disappeared sometime between Wednesday, December 28th and Friday, December 30th, 2005. At the time of her disappearance, Sandra lived in a home on Moffett Place in Temple Terrace, Florida. When last seen, Sandra was described as a white female with brown hair and eyes, standing 5 feet 6 inches tall and weighing approximately 100 pounds. Sandra wears rimless eyeglasses and her ears are pierced. Sandra was 59 years old in 2005, and if alive today, she would have turned 76 this week in March of 2022. Several items reported missing from Sandra's home have never been recovered. These include a towel from her master bathroom, her purse, her debit card, a picture of her and Earl Pippin previously kept on her bedside table, and the journals in which she and her gardener, David Jarrett, corresponded. Sandra's white, four-door, 1994 Buick Park Avenue car was found in her garage. There was blood evidence discovered in the trunk, on the garage floor beneath the vehicle, and on the overhead door, as well as on her bedroom floor. It's believed that Sandra's car was driven for up to 48 hours after her disappearance by an unknown individual who accessed two of her bank accounts. This unidentified man, disguising himself beneath a green ski mask, apparently took in the neighborhood of $800. One ATM was a walk-up while the other was a drive-thru. The two banks were noted as being a Wachovia on North 56th Street and Tampa Bay Federal Credit Union on North Florida Avenue. The suspect, seen by a witness without his mask on, was described as being white or light-skinned, male, and in his mid-30s to early 40s, standing 5 feet 11 inches tall and weighing between 215 and 245 pounds. At the time, he had dark hair and was clean-shaven. Video and photo still images are available of the suspect in both color and black and white. This December will mark 17 years since Sandra mysteriously vanished. In all of that time, while Pippin was named a person of interest, Sandra herself has never been located, nor have any arrests been made. While investigators have never revealed all of the evidence they've collected in this case, it's believed that they need something more before they can finally file charges. A $100,000 reward remains in place for information leading to Sandra's remains or an arrest. For Sandra's friends and family, they continue to hope that someday they'll not only find out what became of Sandra, but they will see the person responsible charged. Asked about the loss of her dear friend after so many years, Susan Horton replied, quote, "She just wouldn't fall off the face of the earth. I personally believe that she was murdered. There seems to be enough trace evidence that we've been able to figure it out from what detectives are able to tell us. We feel that someone out there has some information. Maybe they don't even know they have information. Hopefully, by her story being out again, it will ring a bell." I think we've all seen commercials and visited sites that offer DNA tests to unlock the mysteries of our pasts. While that's always a fun and interesting thing to do, it's not uncommon to receive surface-level results leaving you wanting more answers, and that's where GenomeLink comes in. GenomeLink aims to help people get the most value out of their genetic results. GenomeLink doesn't perform DNA tests. Instead, they use those test results to provide more in-depth information based on that person's genetics. GenomeLink has a team of dedicated researchers who have curated over 10,000 genetic studies to build a database and algorithm for accurate DNA genetic testing. In layman's terms, they're working hard to stay ahead of the curve with the most recent developments in the genomics field and to help you connect with the most recent and relevant genetic research. Don't just settle for your basic DNA analysis. Upload your DNA test results from anywhere like Ancestry, 23andMe, or MyHeritage and find out what makes you, well, you. We all know that DNA testing has helped solve many unsolved crimes. GenomeLink can provide you with in-depth information about yourself and your ancestry. GenomeLink analyzes your raw DNA data and gives you access to many more results and information that isn't provided by companies when you get your original DNA test. Personal trait reports provide you with personalized advice for fitness, nutrition, mental well-being, and even skincare. GenomeLink is set up in accordance with the requirements of the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, or HIPAA, the federal level security standards for safeguarding protected health information, so your information is safe and secure. Discover your full genetic potential by uploading your existing DNA test results at genomelink.io. Get access to over 25 free trait reports and receive your results instantly. No trial period, no credit card, and no hidden fees. Go to genomelink.io. Sign up today and discover your full genetic potential. This episode is sponsored by Surfshark. Have you ever noticed that it seems like the internet is getting more dangerous by the second? Well, that's because it is. Hackers have more ways to target you, trackers are following your every move, and malware is hiding all over the web. Luckily, there's a solution. You can get a VPN. A VPN will hide your real location, making you more difficult to identify and target, but privacy and security are not all that Surfshark has to offer. If you use a VPN, you can forget about geo restrictions. You ever watch a video and get confronted by a message that it isn't available in your area? Well, with Surfshark, you'll be able to access everything, from news sources to social media apps that are unavailable to you because of your location. Just change your virtual location and access all the entertainment you want safely and securely. So try Surfshark risk-free with a 30-day money-back guarantee. Get Surfshark VPN at surfshark.deals/trace. Enter promo code TRACE for 83% off and 3 extra months free. That's surfshark.deals/trace. Use promo code TRACE for 83% off and 3 extra months free. Surfshark.deals/trace, promo code TRACE. The disappearance of Sandra Prince is one of those cases where it seems like all of the pieces are on the board, but you just can't find a way to make them fit. When you compare it to a lot of cases I've previously covered, there's a lot here. You've got a motive, a timeline, a person of interest, blood evidence, surveillance footage, and an eyewitness. That being said, sometimes having a lot of information and no way to make it stick can be a hell of a lot more frustrating than not even having a place to begin with at all. I imagine, for Sandra's friends and family, as well as investigators, there's little that's more disheartening than feeling like you've gotten all the answers, but you can't prove it. Outside of her public life, we don't know a great deal about Sandra Prince. Almost everyone who knew her described her as kind, caring, and compassionate, with a sharp mind and a focus on helping others. She helped grow ACT into what it is today, and she helped out in her own private life as well, renting out Section 8 housing, making sure everything was taken care of, providing donations to charitable organizations, and frequently writing thank you notes to those she employed or was a patron of. At the core of this case is the part of Sandra's life she didn't choose to share, the more intimate side. A 59-year-old, twice divorced, many have commented on feeling that while Sandra had an outwardly beaming persona, on the inside, she was lonely. Whether it was by confiding to people such as her massage therapist and personal shopper, or the long, thoughtful correspondence she kept up with David Jarrett, it was clear to some that there was a piece of Sandra that longed for someone to be at her side. Now, according to investigators, that role was filled by Earl Pippin, who she hired on as a general contractor after being connected via her feng shui consultant. With Sandra vanishing in December of 2005 and police saying her relationship with Pippin went back 5 years, that would place the genesis of that relationship in 2000, which coincides with her purchasing the home on Moffett Place. Due to limited information ever being released about this 5-year period, we can't know what kind of a relationship the two had nor how it developed. We do know that, on several occasions, Sandra told people that she was seeing someone. In some instances, she'd reveal that he was a married man. In others, she'd say he was someone she owned property with. On rare occasions, she'd give the name Earl. Many of the people who were very close to Sandra didn't know all of the details, while others, people kept on the periphery, had a better idea of what was going on. It seems implied that while Sandra knew he was married and that the relationship would never last, she couldn't help but hope for something more to come out of it. If indeed investigators are accurate in stating that her will listed Pippin as the sole beneficiary to her estate, one might ask, was this due to her romantic feelings, or was it a matter of leaving her estate to someone with whom she'd invested in other properties? Many suspected that Sandra's will would have left something to the company she'd helped start, or family members with whom she maintained close contact. We've never really gotten much of an absolute about this, and I imagine the only people with true insight might be Sandra's lawyer, police, and maybe Pippin himself, though he denied any knowledge of being in her will. What does that leave us with? A well-liked, admired, and respected woman going missing one day in December, and nearly 17 years later, the answers are still lost. So, let's start with what we know. On December 28, 2005, Sandra logs into her home computer and uses her credit card for the last time. Her maid notes this is also the last day in which she saw a photo of Sandra and Pippin on the bedside table. At least one employee tells police he remembers seeing Sandra at work 2 days later on the 30th. However, when asked for more information, he says he thinks he saw her that day, but he can't know for sure. It was a busy week. Christmas had just happened and New Year's was approaching. Days blur together, especially when you're asked about it more than a week later. Like investigators, we don't know when exactly Sandra went missing, but if she were in the habit of using her home computer on a daily basis, it's compelling to know that that stopped on the 28th. I think another primary reason for choosing this date has to do with surveillance footage from those two ATMs. Being that the police said the unknown man making withdrawals was driving Sandra's car, and that the car had been driven for 2 days after her disappearance, it seems likely that the bank transactions occurred between the 28th and the 31st. Of course, the question becomes, was Sandra already the victim of a crime at this point in time? Was she still alive, or had she been disposed of? Given the blood evidence in the trunk, the garage, and in her bedroom, it seems quite clear that something violent happened in that house between the 28th and 3rd when she was reported missing. When police were finally called and arrived at the house on Moffett Place, they made note of several things. Sandra's cell phone, which she always carried, was left behind, while her purse, which held her debit card, was missing. There's the previously mentioned blood evidence, a missing towel from the master bath, the missing journals kept between Sandra and her gardener, David Jarrett, and the photo of the couple from her bedside table. Now, from what we've been told, there wasn't blood evidence found between the bedroom and the garage, which makes me believe that the missing towel was likely wrapped around what I presume was a head wound that Sandra sustained. We also know that someone attempted to clean up the evidence, both in the garage and in the bedroom. So, sometime between the 28th and the 3rd, someone goes to Sandra's house, at which time a physical altercation occurs, likely resulting in Sandra's death. That person or persons moves the body into the trunk of her car. They attempt to clean the place up, remove the journals, take the photo, and grab Sandra's purse. Then the decision is made to use Sandra's own car to visit the ATMs while wearing a weird-ass green ski mask as a disguise. After withdrawing what's been noted as being approximately $800, this person returns to the Moffett Place home and parks the car back in the garage. Now, here's something interesting. Jarrett tells investigators that on December 28th, he placed a call to Sandra at approximately 7 a.m. and it went unanswered. He then stopped by the house to drop off a Christmas gift, and while he received no answer on the phone or at the door, he did notice that her car was in the garage. He then used one of their journals to leave her a note about this visit. He again states he called Sandra's cell phone but received no answer. So we know, at a minimum, the journals are in the garage on the morning of the 28th. Sandra's still alive at this time, as police later state that this is the day where she last used her credit card and computer. This would move the crime starting at the earliest to the evening of the 28th. The next day, on the 29th, Jarrett returns to the house and lets himself in with a key that Sandra had previously given him. He notes that her phone is on the counter, the house appears clear, and that there's a white Bible lying on her bed. Returning to the garage, the car is still there, and Jarrett finds that Sandra hasn't written back to him, confirming that at least the journal they were using at the time was still there. So I have to ask, if Sandra's murdered on the 28th, why is the journal still there the next day? And how thoroughly did the killer manage to clean up the garage and bedroom so that Jarrett didn't notice any trace of blood or signs of a struggle? According to Jarrett, he assumed that Sandra was away for the holiday, but when he got home that day, he couldn't get it out of his mind. So he confided in his wife that he was worried about her, and they agreed to return the following day, December 30th. Here, it's reported they find the house in the same condition as the previous day. Unfortunately, there's no report as to whether or not the journal was still in the garage. Either way, neither Jarrett nor his wife see anything out of the ordinary. Jarrett tells police he then spoke to the neighbor, Nancy Sackville, and while they were worried, neither wants to call police on the chance that Sandra's just away for the weekend. Nancy agrees to keep an eye on the house and to let Jarrett know if she sees Sandra or anyone else. Now, here's something else that's bugging me. This cul-de-sac on which Sandra lives is described as being private, with neighbors being acutely aware of their comings and goings. They were well used to one another's schedules, enough to notice when something was off, and they were suspicious of any vehicles entering the neighborhood that were unfamiliar. So how did someone get into Sandra's home and commit this heinous crime, take her car out, bring it back, clean up the evidence, and nobody noticed anything? Well, to me, there's two possibilities. Either this all happened during late night hours and no one noticed, or the person arriving and leaving that house wasn't someone who would have stuck out as not belonging, making it someone who neighbors had seen before. Let's face it, there doesn't appear to be anything even remotely random about this crime. I fully agree with the police and the FBI that Sandra was victimized by someone in her life, someone she likely knew and trusted. So it would make sense that no one noticed an out-of-place vehicle or person. But unless investigators are keeping it to themselves, there's never been a report of neighbors seeing either Jarrett or Pippin at the house in the days leading up to the report that Sandra was missing. Whether or not anyone saw them there, or anyone else, we simply don't know. On January 3rd, Jarrett returns to the house, and for the first time, he sees something different. While Sandra's car remains parked in the garage, a note is now attached to it explaining that the alarm kept going off, so the battery had to be disconnected. According to Jarrett, this note is signed Earl. I think it's worth noting that, according to a manual for Sandra's car, in order to stop the alarm from going off when starting the car, the driver would need to depress the brake while turning the key. In order to stop the alarm from going off when turning the car off again, you also have to depress the brake before pulling the key out. In addition to this, if you do not lock the car when you walk away from it, it will go off. Curiously, there's no reports of neighbors hearing the alarm, and someone familiar with the car may have known the methods by which to ensure the alarm didn't go off. If indeed Pippin and Sandra had been in a relationship for the previous 5 years, it seems odd that he didn't know how to stop the alarm outside of disconnecting the battery. Then again, we've never heard any reports about whether or not Sandra's car keys were ever found. Moments later, Pippin himself enters the garage and tells Jarrett that he was looking for a pipe wrench that he'd left behind during a previous visit. This is another aspect that interests me. Jarrett has said that he'd recalled seeing Pippin at the house a few times in the past, but he didn't know him. Nor did he know that Sandra was seeing him, and apparently had been for 5 years. Later, though, Jarrett tells police that 6 months prior to her disappearance, Sandra told him about the falling out she'd had with Pippin's son, Patrick. I suppose she could have done so without mentioning names, or maybe she did mention names, but didn't note that she was dating Pippin. Nancy Sackville comes by next, and after the three confer about how none of them have seen Sandra in at least a week, Jarrett calls the police to report her missing. After the call, but prior to the arrival of investigators, Pippin leaves. While he claims he has to take his son to the doctor, he tells police that he went to the Axe offices, but his cell phone pings off towers, showing him heading towards the South Tampa area. He later gives police two possible job sites he may have been heading towards, both of which, according to investigators, were already completed by this time. This leaves only the West Vasconia Street house, or possibly Pippin's own home, which was located 2 miles away. As the investigation kicks off, police are trying to figure out more about Sandra's private life. They learn about Pippin from a few different sources. While Pippin will later claim total innocence, I think it's difficult to ignore that much of the suspicion and confusion around him was, in part, done by his own hand. According to police, he initially denies having a relationship with Sandra or co-owning property with her. Both of these details are later proven to be true. He isn't very accurate in telling detectives about his travels that day, after leaving the house, but before police arrived. Now, maybe he was looking to downplay the relationship because he didn't want his wife finding out. That, I could somewhat understand. However, given the gravity of the circumstances, his priorities may have been out of whack. After consulting with the FBI, the police begin to focus in around the painting that Sandra commissioned, which shows her and David Jarrett working in the garden. According to investigators, when first asked about this, Pippin claims he thought the man in the painting was the artist. When asked a second time, he says that Jarrett told him he was the one in the picture. In a third round of questioning, he says that Sandra initially asked him to be in the painting, and when he declined, he said it would be all right if Jarrett was in it. Police believe at this point that Sandra was likely murdered, and their motive is based around jealousy. The FBI profiler tells them that the killer experienced a narcissistic injury and may have lashed out based around that painting. When Jarrett was asked about the correspondence he and Sandra kept in the missing journals, he did say that, to an outsider, it might seem flirtatious. So, did Pippin kill Sandra because of what he may or may not have read in those journals, stacked on top of his feelings about the painting? We have no way of knowing, though people have certainly killed for far less than that. I've always wondered if indeed that was the motive, why leave that painting behind? Maybe taking it or destroying it might give further support to the jealousy theory, but were that the case, why take the journals? Unless, of course, they contained information that might give police other reasons to want to look at him. Removing the photo from the bedroom seems a little odd, too. Maybe Pippin was trying to sever any connection he had to Sandra, but he had to know there were people out there who were aware of their relationship. Or maybe he believed Sandra kept things as close to herself as she always did. So, let's take a moment to look towards motive. Initially, any motive assigned to Pippin revolved around jealousy, but quickly turned to money. As the sole beneficiary, he would be set to profit should anything happen to Sandra. However, he was already profiting from her. Together, the two purchased a home, which Pippin then worked on, as Don Watkins previously said, why kill the golden goose? I've got an additional question. If you were set to inherit that estate, would you go out of your way to withdraw $800 from Sandra's accounts, having to go so far as to disguise yourself in the process? That's never made a lot of sense to me, but maybe someone was trying to confuse investigators or send them down the wrong road. I also wonder, why was the car brought back to the house? If indeed Sandra was killed and then the killer decided to try and grab some quick cash from the bank using that car, why the hell would you bring it back there? It seems like something someone young and foolish might do, thinking it would help cover the situation up, or just someone who wasn't very intelligent. You're essentially hand-delivering evidence to the police, so why do it? You could dump the car in a lake, leave it in a bad part of town, abandon it in the middle of nowhere, set it on fire. The only real reasons I can come up with for bringing it back are, you need to get back to Moffitt Place, because that's where you've left your own car, or you're thinking you can clean things up enough that it'll look like the car never went anywhere. Police would go on to conduct two prolonged, extensive digs at the West Vesconia Street home where Pippin was working around the time Sandra vanished. According to their warrants, the first dig, which involved taking dirt samples, concluded that human remains were present beneath the home. This either means that the body was there at some point and was moved, or the body was there and was missed during the search, or the analysis was inaccurate. In hopes of finding something, they essentially gutted that house, but nothing was found. While that was disappointing to say the least, investigators did find something which turned their attention towards Pippin's son, Patrick. According to affidavits, David Jarrett told police that 6 months prior to her disappearance, Sandra had had an argument with Patrick revolving around rent. Allegedly, he wanted to stay in one of her Lake Panasoffkee properties without paying rent, and when she balked, he became upset. Sandra then drafted a letter to Patrick, which she mailed, but for one reason or another, it came back to her address as undeliverable. This letter was postmarked December 17th, 10 to 13 days before Sandra went missing. Eventually, police obtained a warrant allowing them to read the letter, though they've never revealed what it said. Is it possible that, in conjunction with potential jealousy, that Pippin may have also been angered about Sandra wanting to charge his son rent? Maybe? So where does that leave us? Earl Pippin remains a person of interest, but's never been charged, and police have seemingly struggled to find any evidence which can directly tie him to Sandra's disappearance. Patrick, not a person of interest, hasn't had to speak to police, and unless something has changed in the past 9 years that wasn't announced, he never has. Now, I don't know what exactly they're hoping to find out from him, but I imagine it would be about his relationship with Sandra and, perhaps more importantly, his father's relationship with her. I think it's worth noting that in 2005, Patrick would have been around 18 years old. I've seen speculation in a lot of places online that maybe he was the man hitting the ATMs, but unless the eyewitness is way off, it's somewhat hard to confuse an 18-year-old with someone in their mid-30s to mid-40s. If we approach this case from the angle investigators have worked, it sounds like it would have played out something like this. Sometime in the evening of Wednesday, December 28th, or perhaps the 29th, Pippin stops by the Moffitt Place home. Whether he's already angry or becomes angry, an altercation occurs between him and Sandra, which results in her being severely injured. Pippin then places her body in the trunk of her car and drives off to an unknown location. After disposing of the body, he returns to the house and begins the cleanup in the garage and bedroom. At some point, either on or after the 28th, He removes the picture of the two of them from the bedroom, takes Sandra's purse, grabs the journals, and goes to dispose of all of it. Then, somewhere along the way, the decision is made to take her car and hit ATMs using her debit card. I can't exactly understand why this was done, especially for such a small amount. You'd think if you were intending to make police believe this was a random robbery, you'd go out of your way to ensure that you didn't bring that car back to the house. After that, it's just a matter of deny, 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 and hire a lawyer. Seemingly, at least the latter occurred. I can't help but wonder, though, about the way investigators frequently mention that they hadn't ruled out the possibility that more than one person was involved. While I haven't seen anyone put forth the theory, there's always been a part of me that's wondered if they're referring to Patrick. Could he have been involved, after the fact, in covering up the crime? Might he have taken the car in hopes of getting money from the bank, planning to return it without anyone, including his father, knowing and something went wrong? Is it possible that he was involved in the assault that led to Sandra's death and Pippin, for his part, worked overtime trying to cover for him? All of those are interesting questions, but there are no answers, nor is there any proof or information to lend credence to any of it. Everyone who has examined this case tends to come to the same resolution as detectives, that Pippin knows more than he said and remains the only person of interest in the case. Since 2013, there hasn't been any breaking news or major developments. Pippin has remained silent, police haven't mentioned him again, and where the investigation currently sits is unknown. I imagine it's a cold case at this point, and it'll be looked at periodically until new information is found or someone comes forward with what they know. Either way you cut it, this is one of the more bizarre and frustrating cases I've ever featured on Trace Evidence. A missing woman, a car stolen and returned, blood cleaned up, missing journals, a missing picture, a $6,000 portrait, an estate valued at $3 million. It would make a hell of a game of Clue if it wasn't also sad, tragic, and heartbreaking. So, what do you think happened here? Do you agree with police that Pippin is the person who warrants the closest scrutiny? Do you think there could be some angle that involves Patrick in one way or another? Do you think more than one person was involved? And where exactly was Sandra taken? Many people, including those who knew and loved her, can't help but wonder if there might be some answers somewhere beneath the waters of her beloved Lake Panasoffkee. Unfortunately, without new evidence, the discovery of Sandra's remains, or someone coming forward with information, the disappearance of Sandra Prince will remain open, unsolved, and growing cold. If you're looking for more information about the disappearance of Sandra Prince, the Tampa Bay Times and the Tampa Tribune had the most extensive coverage. If you have any information about the disappearance of Sandra Prince, please contact the Temple Terrace Police Department at 813-989-7110. Her case is number 06-00030. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod, message me on Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com, or comment in the Facebook group. Just a quick reminder that I'll be attending CrimeCon in Las Vegas representing Trace Evidence on Podcast Row. To save 10% off your pass, use promo code TRACE at CrimeCon.com. Trace Evidence would not be possible without support from amazing listeners like you. And now I'd like to take a moment to thank our fantastic Patreon producers, Alicia Lorraine, Anne Bertram, Brittany Bivens, Christine Greco, Krista Colvin, Denise Dingsdale, Donna Buttram, Diane Dyson, Eamon Brady, Eloann Meyer, Eric Sumpter, Guillerme Pinto, Haley Christie, James, Jen Treb, Jennifer Winkler, Jill Sentz, Joni Berkowitz, Julie Mangano, Kara Moreland, Lars Jensen Fangel, Leslie B., Marla Wright, Melissa Brakeisen, Nick Mohar Schurz, Orange Patches, Quinn McBreen, Roberta Jansen, Sarah Levinen, Sarah Lyons, Travis Skepko, Stacy Finnegan, Stephanie Joyner, Stephanie Eve, Adorable Susie Summers, Taylor, Tom Archer, Tom Radford, and Tracy Woods. Your contributions to Trace Evidence are invaluable, and your support of the show is both appreciated and extremely humbling. If you're interested in supporting Trace Evidence and gaining access to exclusive merch and ad-free episodes, please visit patreon.com/traceevidence or go to trace-evidence.com and click on the support option. This concludes our look into the disappearance of Sandra Prince, one of the more mystifying cases I've dug into in recent years. Hopefully, sooner than later, they'll finally get some of those needed answers. So, thank you all again for listening, and I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.